My guess is Catlin Moran. As a result of her longtime columns for the Times of London, books like How to Be a Woman and How to Build a Girl, and the TV series that she wrote called Raised by Wolves, Catlin Moran estimates that she's actually 35% famous. But perhaps she'll experience a popularity bump with her new collection of Times columns called Moranifesto. In it, she blends humor and research to offer her thoughts on everything from economics, feminism, and the way the media cover the crisis in Syria, to what it's like to meet Benedict Cumberbatch, or have Daft Punk's song, Get Lucky, stuck in your head for three straight weeks. It's published by Harper Perennial, and I'm very pleased it has brought Catlin Moran to our show today. Hello.
Hello, gorgeous. It's lovely to be here.
35%? How did you come up with that figure?
Based on going down the street and noticing how often I would get stopped. And I could tell what kind of... Basically, I would be stopped. If you are a girl with eyeliner and sensible shoes on, such as brogues, and you're wearing maybe a duffel coat, and you are maybe slightly overweight, then you will recognise me, and you will want to come over and talk to me about how my books have changed your life. If you're a straight white guy who's on his way to a big important business meeting, you will not know who I am.
Welcome to the world of radio.
It's so lovely.
People think they know me, but they don't recognize me. Mostly.
Until you talk, I would imagine. And then they're like, oh, my God, cue in the news. Tell me something about the weather. That's sexy.
You've been writing columns for the Times for 23 years since you were 17?
Yes, I know.
How did you get a job at that age?
No one's more surprised than me. I was raised by hippies who believed that the apocalypse was coming in Wolverhampton, which is a very depressed industrial town in the Midlands.
But it has good soccer team, good football team.
I believe so. Well, I mean, as a very overweight girl who was dressed all the time in secondhand hippie clothes, football was just a dangerous thing to me because every time there was a football match, I would probably get shouted at by men. So I was homeschooled by my parents, and we were very poor. We were raised on welfare. And when I was 13, I realised I would have to save my family. And so I wrote my first novel, which got published when I was 15. And then I got offered a column by the Observer newspaper when I was 15, and I started writing for them. And then I transferred to the Times when I was 17 by just faxing them a column and going, would you like me to be your new columnist? And they said yes. And it's only recently I've realised that's quite an unusual way to get a column in a national newspaper.
You say that when you first got hired, you try to stay funny and mostly avoided writing about politics.
Yes. Well, if you're a 17-year-old working-class girl who constantly wears a hat under the belief that if your head looks bigger, your body will look smaller by way of comparison, you don't really feel qualified to write about politics when everybody else who's writing about politics on the time used to be in the government. But when I wrote a book about feminism, how to be a woman in whenever it was, and it sold a million copies around the world, and lots of people who previously had not described themselves as feminists went, I read your funny, rude book about feminism, and now I know I'm a feminist. I thought, well, could I not do the same with politics? You don't need to have all these qualifications. I can just apply the same blend of humour and common sense to talk about the political situation.
Had you intended it to be funny, rude?
Well, I'm just God made me that way. That's just how I came out.
Do you think that other women struggle to recognize that they can write authoritatively on those issues?
I think it's very hard to have the confidence of a woman because you're always aware that you're other, and necessarily you're going to see things differently from how the establishment, which is generally male and straight and white, thinks. And if you're saying something different to what everybody else is saying, you will often preface it with, I think I've probably got this wrong. You'll presume that you're wrong. But one thing that gave me confidence to write this book now was realizing that no one knows what they're doing. I mean, since the 2008 crash, when you would see all these experts coming onto the news every night and people were going, why has there been a crash and what will happen now? And all these big, you know, captains of industry and sort of like, well, you know, Wall Street titans were like, we don't know. And we don't know what to do next. We don't know how to deal with this. And I was like, oh my God, if they don't know, now they're finally admitting they don't know. Maybe I can have a pop.
The experts predicted that Brexit would fail and that Hillary Clinton would be elected president of the United States. So,
I know. I'd like to still stay in the room of the experts because it seems like it would be a nicer emotional climate in there. Yeah, I mean, what you're noticing at the moment is what I've tried to write about in the book is how I think if you're of the left and you're liberal, it's quite easy to be despairing at the moment and to think that something is happening politically that we don't understand that might be huge and long-lasting and means something about humanity that we hadn't thought about before. But I see it from a cultural point of view. I don't think this is a huge political change. I think this is a cultural change, and it's been predicated by the internet. We are in the middle of the biggest migration in human history. It's not the 60 million refugees that are on the move at the moment. It's 3.7 billion people now live, to all intents and purposes, on the internet, which basically works like California during the Gold Rush. You know, there's no law there, really. People are told abuse on the internet is not a real crime. Cybercrime is not a real crime. It's mainly very young and very male and very lawless. And this
is the
tone.
Do you get trolled a lot?
Yeah, I mean, you know how you can tell if you're a woman in the 21st century? Because you will have had a lot of rape and death threats. And I've just found recently that just going, "your mum," and then blocking them tends to get rid of them quite quickly. So this is the internet, this place where we all live now, this uncharted, unplanned territory that's been thrown up really hastily and now controls, you know, the way that we think and talk about things and has dictated the political environment, is like California during the Gold Rush. It's completely lawless. And I think we need to start looking at how we plan this, how we talk about this. We are here now. Let's start putting some laws in. Let's start planning it.
You wrote about an incident involving Caroline Criado Perez, somebody who's known in England but not here.
Yeah, she's a remarkable woman. I mean, one of the things that I love to do, one of the reasons that I want to write about politics is to make people realise that you can change things. Like, once you understand how a nuclear bomb works, because only one atom, only one nucleus hits some kind of radioactive material and then it causes other atoms around it. It's a chain reaction. So you just need to change one thing to make the world different, either constructively or deconstructively. Caroline Criado Perez was just a normal woman with a laptop who looked at the banknotes that we have in our country and noted that they were just about to stop having Florence Nightingale, the only woman on our banknotes, and otherwise it would be all men on banknotes.
Well, there is the Queen.
Yeah, but that's a hereditary role, like, kind of, you know, that's, you know, I mean, that's very much against feminism to think that that would count. And so she just fought a campaign to make sure that there would be a woman on a banknote, and sure enough, there was Jane Austen. And that was just one woman that changed money. You know, in a capitalist society, a woman changed what money is and what it is in our hands. That's extraordinary.
But then she received a lot of angry tweets.
Yes, and then she spent 2 years being threatened continually to the point where she had to move house, where she became under police protection. And so, you know, that was one of the reasons why I wanted to sort of talk about the internet and go kind of, you know, with every good force that's out there, if we have this lawless environment where crimes are allowed to happen without being punished, we stop progress. We make people scared, and you have what you have now, which is the loudest, most powerful voice wins out every time, and that is to the detriment of our society.
You were worried after your book was published once you became a professional feminist person on the op-ed page, you had to abandon the pop culture and funny stuff that you had started out with. Are those things mutually exclusive?
Well, in my naivety, I thought they would be, because I thought if one week I was writing about my constant urinary tract infections and the next week I was writing about Syria, that I would undermine what I was doing. But We live pluralistic lives. We are human beings. One day we're doing something silly with our kids, and the next day we're worrying about the election. So to be able to write about these things, I mean, I know that my power is that most people who wouldn't normally read about politics or read about feminism will read my stuff because it will be funny and accessible. And, you know, the way that I write is to make them feel, when they get to the end of something, rather than feeling despairing, as you often do at the end of reading a column, or having your thoughts affirmed and allowing you to stay in your little bubble of your thoughts, that I will have changed your mind and that I will have made you think, oh, I could do something about this. I am part of this society. I could be the, you know, the atom that explodes that changes something.
You have a checklist in your book for when we know that equality of the sexes has finally arrived.
Yes.
It includes standard clauses like equal pay and equal representation in parliament, but also things like a woman should be able to go up and collect her Oscar in comfortable shoes.
Yes. Well, this is, I mean, the Oscars are fascinating, aren't they? Because they're the biggest prize-giving ceremony on earth. This is kind of, you know, the one that all the focus of the world is upon. Men go there and they are all dressed comfortably. And afterwards, when the business is being done at the parties, they're standing there in their comfortable shoes and they can do business and make deals. The women will probably have left that party because they're in such agony they've had to take their shoes off. It's this whole thing of like, why aren't women in the room? Why aren't women getting to make these decisions? Why is it still 93% of directors are men? I would suggest a lot of it is because the female directors who should have been there in that room making that deal, their feet hurt a lot and they've simply had to go home and cry.
What are some of the other things on the list?
Something like a woman being able to just eat a sausage at her desk at work and not feel guilty about it and not have to say things like, oh, I'm pigging out or I'm being really naughty. Just eat the sausage, ladies. Just eat the sausage.
My guest is Catlin Moran, and her latest book is Moranifesto. You write about how the idea of revolution may be different for a young man than it is for a 40-year-old woman with very inferior running abilities and two children.
I run like a wind-up penguin. It is not a world. I'm not Usain Bolt. Yeah, there are two We've been talking a lot. You hear the word revolution a lot at the moment. You know, politically in both Europe and America, cataclysmic things are happening. There is a revolution. And there are two dictionary definitions of revolution. The first is riot, insurrection, upheaval, overturn. The second one is upgrade, metamorphosis. And I think the second definition of revolution is the one that we want, because in violent revolutions, when people are talking about violent protest against votes, you know, getting out there and making your voice heard by protesting, that is an environment that only favours young, fit, usually men. Women, children, old people, people of different colours who feel vulnerable in those kind of crowd situations, they can't take part in those kind of revolutions. They need ones of thought and speech.
Does feminism today have to be more inclusive of women of different ages, ethnicities, sexual orientation, gender identities, etc.?
Obviously. I mean, the whole idea about feminism is there is no feminism university, there is no president of feminism, there are no laws of feminism. It's an idea. It's a concept. It's the idea of equality. And it only works if everybody believes in equality. So the more people believe in equality, the more it works. If the less people who believe in it, it doesn't exist. When, for instance, people say men can't be feminists, if every single woman in the world said that she was a feminist, but every single man was told he couldn't be, we won't have equality. It's an idea necessarily that has to include everybody.
When an equal rights amendment was proposed in this country, its chief opponent was a woman, Phyllis Schlafly.
I don't know about anything about America, apart from this is where Bill Murray came from, and I love Ghostbusters. But if I looked into that, I'm sure I'd be able to write something brilliant and exactly 850 words long by 4 o'clock this afternoon.
And did you get involved in the controversy over the new Ghostbusters? The
yes.
Female version?
Well, I didn't get involved in it. I sat there boggling and just going, it has come to this. Like, kind of like, if an idea, come on, the idea of busting ghosts is great. And I can't see in any way that it's predicated by gender whether you can bust ghosts or not. When you're a man standing at a keyboard crying, going, my childhood is ruined because ladies are now going to bust ghosts, then you need to talk about your childhood, not Ghostbusters.
Is Brexit a feminist issue?
Well, yes, in that it is a vote for fear and misinformation. And at any point where we become scared and we're voting for fear, essentially Brexit is because, I mean, everything that's happened here and everything that's happened in America and with Brexit is because of the 2008 crash. The 2008 crash happened. We knew that living standards were going to drop between 25 and 45%, and no one got punished. No one was sent to jail. Nothing changed. And so there was a lot of anger.
In England as well?
Yeah, no one. The only place that anywhere was prosecuted was in Iceland, who have a lesbian, radical left-wing government. Nice one, guys. No one got punished. And if you do that, you will create an enormous amount of anger and energy in people who see that something has happened that has changed the economics of the world and has directly impacted on their lives, and nothing has happened. And so what needed to happen was, in order to stop that energy filtering upwards, you know, to the elite, to the people who have money, to the banks, we had to create an underclass of people so we could direct that energy downwards. You know, if you've got an oppressed people who've just been screwed over by a political and economic system, and, you know, to stop them having a revolution, you need to create a subclass, an underclass. And that's what we've done with immigration. We've done that with race. And that affects anybody who is a minority in any of these countries.
In a column for The Times this past weekend, you placed partial blame for Hillary Clinton's election loss on Hollywood.
Yes.
Why?
Well, I am also a scriptwriter and I write films. And last week I was on Hampstead Heath and I saw a delightful, kooky, beautiful blonde lady who had 5 dogs on leads. And it was very clear to me she must be a dog walker. And I was just like, that's such a great job for a girl in a film, because that's the kind of jobs that girls in films have. Girls basically have to have delightful jobs in films. They have to want to open a cake shop like in Bridesmaids, or they have to be a PA to a crazy lady like in The Devil Wears Prada, or they have to be a nanny or a children's illustrator like in Paddington. You have to have a delightful job. You have to have a job that allows you to wear whatever clothes you want, because that's 50% of a woman's personality is what she's wearing. You have to have a job that's flexible enough for you to take part in your male lead's life so you can go off and deal with his crises and your job not to get in the way. And most importantly, you need to have a job that doesn't make you ugly or fat or slouch or change people's lives or have to lie or have to make compromising decisions or decisions that change the world. And, you know, and that's what you see with Hillary. You see someone who had to talk sternly, you know, who would slouch, who had put on weight, who'd become old, who wanted to change things, who had to, you know, talk politically rather than just emotionally and kookily and delightfully like girls do. And we just haven't seen that story. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why Hillary was not elected.
So you talk about ugly jobs.
Yeah, I love using words like fat and ugly. You know, these are words that are bandied around all the time as pejoratives. But this is, you know, the reality is that women live in fear of being called fat or ugly, and men are not.
We don't have much more time, but I'm going to ask that almost impossible question you tend to ask at the end of these kinds of conversations.
So long as it's not about maths, I'm confident I can answer it.
How do we change things?
Well, I mean, genuinely and literally by buying my book.
That's it.
it's that whole thing. You can. This isn't a political problem. This is a cultural problem, and people can change cultural problems. I've suggested everybody writes a manifesto and checks the way that they talk. If you don't have an idea yourself, make sure you're conducting other people's good and positive ideas, and don't give up on hope. That's the most important thing. Things can change so quickly. David Bowie in 1969 was a gay man wearing a dress, and that was not a good thing to be. 2 years later, he'd written Life on Mars, and people were walking around in dresses wanting to be David Bowie. You don't argue what's right or wrong, you just make the right thing cool, like David Bowie did.
Caitlin Moran, her book Moranifesto is available in this country from Harper Perennial. Thank you so much for stopping by.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you, darling.